Good morning, everybody. So welcome. Glad you're here. I'm glad to be here. I'm Rob Gonzalez. I'm more than just Russell's brother. Hopefully I can demonstrate that as we're going along today. And I might throw in a few stories about him. Thanks for joining me on a topic that I'm very passionate about and that I think is very important. So let me just jump right in. First of all, let me echo the Paul's words of gratitude. I'm a graduate of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and I've served on the board there, and I've been involved throughout the years. So I know the kind of time commitment it takes to be on the board and your investment of your philanthropy as well as your time and your wisdom is appreciated. So thank you. I hope that you can take something out of this that will help long-term your institutions, because I'm passionate about Wesleyan higher education, believe in it very, very strongly. I want to tell you a little bit about me. So I've spent my career in higher education, and I was the chief development officer at Seattle Pacific University, a Free Methodist school, for a number of years. And while I was there, I got inspired by a book called Roaring Lambs. Have any of you read that book? Yeah. And I began thinking, well, you know, there's the entertainment industry, there's journalism, there's all these industries that the Christians to some extent had abandoned or been pushed out of. And I felt like higher education was going in that direction. And I thought I might have the opportunity to pursue a career in higher education and influence and engage that culture for Christ. And so I jumped in. I was at Trinity University down in San Antonio, Santa Clara University as vice presidents at those institutions and a couple of others. And through that journey, you know, hopefully I had an opportunity to influence some folks for the kingdom and influence those institutions and the culture for the kingdom. But if you've been watching the state of American higher education, I wasn't successful in changing those cultures. And so one of these days I'm going to write a follow-up to that book called Simmering Mutton, because it was quite a journey, but that's a different presentation. I also want to mention I want you to know my heart a little bit about, you know, why I took time to come here from California and spend some time with you. I also thought I should let you know that I come with a couple, thank you, come with some vantage points from higher education. I've taught a couple dozen courses, primarily in political science and Western civilization. I've been on a board. I've coached soccer in higher education. I've worked in student affairs. I've been on the Academic Affairs Committee at Oklahoma Wesleyan, and overseen programs, not just your typical advancement programs, fundraising, marketing, alumni relations, and all that, but entrepreneurship programs, performing arts venues, radio stations, international programs, and quite a few other things in various higher education settings. Gigantic public universities of 40,000-plus students, small, hyper-selective liberal arts schools like Trinity, and somewhat small like Santa Clara, and then, of course, Oklahoma Wesleyan as well. So I come with that those vantage points, and so when I look at higher ed advancement, it's not just the fundraising mechanism. It's how it integrates with the whole of a university, and hopefully that will be advantageous as we go along. The other thing I just wanted to, a caveat at the beginning I just wanted to mention is I think philanthropy is serious fun. It's serious business. It's often kind of put off to the side, it's fundraising, it's a bunch of receptions and parties, and you schmooze people and you get them to give money. But it's really a serious business. People giving their money and making major investments is one of the most important decisions they'll ever make. So we need to approach it with a level of seriousness. But yet at the end of the day, it's a joyous, celebratory, fun experience to see somebody have their passions animated through their philanthropy on your campus, and to see that mission advanced because of their philanthropy is a ton of fun. And I've made some great friendships and great relationships along the way. It's also a ministry. Philanthropy, the love of others is what that means. And our job as Christians is to advance, uplift that notion that you should love your fellow man. And philanthropy is one of the most tangible, specific, and difficult ways that people do that. Last caveat. Probably everyone, or most of you in this room, come to your board seat with three roles around philanthropy. You're a trustee. You oversee the enterprise of philanthropy and advancement for your institution. You're also probably a donor. That's a different role than a trustee role, and it's an important role. You're also probably, hopefully, a part-time volunteer fundraiser. That's also a different role. So when you look at trustee governance of philanthropy, those three roles get mixed up a lot, and you bring those to the table with you. And so as you're working with philanthropy and thinking about oversight of philanthropy, it's easy to get those a little bit confused. And I think it's important that you think about which hat you're wearing in which setting. Just a couple caveats to start with, but let me jump in. So I've put together kind of a scattershot of stuff that I think is important for you as board members to think about as you oversee the philanthropy enterprise and hopefully try to grow the philanthropy enterprise. First off, it's a long road. Oklahoma Wesleyan University just got a $4 million gift from Bob and Joyce Campbell. I know Bob and Joyce. I had sleepovers at their house as a kid, and they're wonderful folks. He was an executive in biotech and did really well. And after 40 years of involvement with the university, he made this really significant $4 million gift. He was on the board for a while. He chaired the board for a while, been involved in many, many different ways. And he'd probably given a little bit here and there, but really, frankly, kind of scatterings and smatterings of gifts. And then this. But that's a 40-plus year journey. And those big, large gifts are often that kind of long relationship with the institution. So that's on the individual side. Then as institutions, your pursuit of philanthropy is also the long game. So I know some of you are in campaigns. How many of your institutions are in campaigns? I know Oklahoma Wesleyan's in a $68 million, right? And the others, is that your? Yeah, always in a campaign. Okay. Others are thinking about it. So a campaign from planning to quiet phase to launch to celebration, it's really kind of a 10-year time frame, maybe a 7-year time frame. That's a long time, but it's a blip in the life of your institution. So you not only have to think about the next campaign, you have to think about the campaign after that and the campaign after that, and do you have the structure and the policies and the personnel in place so that philanthropy continues to grow and become a major part of the enterprise decade after decade after decade. There are institutions across this country that have made that serious investment, made the commitment to get good at philanthropy, and their institutions have been transformed from it. So it's a long, long-term goal, and it takes that kind of long-term commitment to get good at it. And you should make the point to get good at philanthropy. You can't depend on just the latest president who might or might not be charming. You can't depend on the latest vice president who might or might not be excellent. As your president. They can't always be as charming as him. So you can't. You can't depend on the personality of the moment. There's culture, there's structure, there's policy, there's investment that needs to be made for the long-term, decade after decade success of philanthropy. One other thing about, as a board, when you think about philanthropy, again, thinking about your three roles, board member, donor, fundraiser, you're still, when you're in the board, you're the board. The board speaks with only one voice in formal meetings on votes. Individual board members are beloved and, of course, will have interactions with the president and other administrators, especially around philanthropy. But even in philanthropy, the board speaks with one voice. And I take a moment to talk about that a little bit because all of you probably have ideas about fundraising. And a good advancement shop will love to hear those ideas. But as a board member, you are not in the seat of making sure that particular idea gets executed. You really like car washes. You think it's the best thing ever for raising money. And so you talk to your vice president and the president, if we just did a car wash every year, we could just make a killing. That's what we should be doing. That may or may not make it into their strategic plans. Now, if you happen to be a $10 million a year donor, it probably is going to get in the plans. But still, try to keep that role of providing ideas but letting go of them. Thoughts in, hands off, right? Heads in, hands off. So you're still a board member speaking as one voice, even though you have those multiple hats to wear. All right. I'm going to jump into some policies, but before I do that, any questions on anything I've covered so far? All right. So these are some policies. You may or may not have some policies around these items, but these are good foundational policies that every institution ought to have. I've put links, and this is electronically in your digital packet. I think there's a website or something that's going to have this, but all these are links to some model policies as well as articles that I think are really good on these policies. I've written each of these policies at different institutions. Part of the reason these policies are important is because donors will press the fundraising staff and the president and others to do this in exchange for their gift, or to name that in exchange for their gift. And it's a great gift to your president and your administration to have these policies in place so that it's not up to them. They can say, well, look, we've got policies, we really need to follow those, and et cetera, et cetera. Again, if you're a $10 million donor, probably the board might change the policy for you, but they should be well thought out policies. First one is gift acceptance. You should know your rules about, do you accept a boat? Do you accept art? How do you accept that art? Do you hold it? Do you sell it? Most gifts don't require policy. It's a stock transfer, cash over time. But real estate, any tangible property, Bitcoin, all that kind of stuff requires some policy guidance. I won't go through into the details of all of those, but each of them have their own set of rules and their own set of guidance, and these documents are some helpful guides on all of that. Gift acceptance policy should be developed in partnership with your finance team, because they're going to be partners in managing those gifts and the disposition of those gifts. But it's important that you've thought through that and you have that policy in place. Naming and recognition. So I've worked at public institutions and private institutions. At public institutions in particular, and even at some of the private universities that I've worked at, there are often donors where it's a quid pro quo exchange. I'm giving the most important thing I want out of this gift is, yeah, it's great, the mission, the students, yeah, that's nice. But I want my name on that building in the biggest letters possible, and arguments over font size and lighting and all that kind of stuff comes up. So it's really good to have a policy on what naming is. And I will also say this, and I think this is probably something that our institutions are a little bit more susceptible to, which is wanting to name someone after something after a beloved professor, beloved president even, or others, because they did a good job while they were there. I would caution you about doing that. It should be extremely rare that you name something based on honorifics. Attach it to a gift. And really, as a board, you can help your administration and others toe the line on that with a good policy that really pushes that any naming ought to be attached to recognition of a philanthropic investment, and even set some thresholds so that it's 50% of the useful life of the building, or the predicted cost of the replacement of the building, or those kinds of guides. It'll help your team and help grow fundraising over time. But it's also just in practice then, it's also good to kind of have an idea of what's available for naming. And I will tell you, one of the things that eats up a ton of time is somebody wants to name a bench, a tree, whatever, which is great. They want to remember a loved one with this, that, or the other thing. And it's good to have a program where you say, this is how we can remember your wonderful friend, family member, whoever that has passed. But it's good to make sure that price really covers the entire full cost. So a bench maybe costs $500 to actually buy if I went out there and installed it myself. But you got to make sure it looks good. You got to make sure it's on a good foundation. You got to make sure the weather. So $5,000 would be a bare minimum of any kind of memorial gift, and probably that's low these days. So it's good to have some kind of program in there. Yeah.
Also, you need to rely on the naming for scholarships or not scholarships, but deans, professorships, those kinds of things. Because that also varies between the cost of hiring a religion professor for an endowed professorship is way less than the cost of hiring a professor for the dean of engineering.
Yeah.
You got to have thresholds.
Great point. I'm going to expand on that a little bit. It's important too to decide if the endowment has to cover the full cost of the chair, because you probably a full cost of a faculty of what $3 million, and when you think about 4 to 5% kick, that's $3 million is probably a bare minimum of what it might cost to cover, and that's probably a religion professor. That's not an engineering or accounting professor. So you probably don't have that many people who are going to make $3 million gifts. So one of the things to think about in endowed chairs and endowed programs, because programs are even more expensive, and an endowment to cover your religion department is probably in the $50 million range, because the annual distribution is such. So one of the things to think about is endowed chairs and endowed positions don't necessarily have to create a new budget line position. You can take an existing position, elevate the prestige of it by calling it the Russ Gonzalez Chair. And don't tell him I said that in religion. And maybe the endowment is $1 million. And that $1 million provides a distribution to support the programs that chair or that position oversees and works with. It's not to support whatever that professor wants. So that's part of the naming policy, because, you know, as a president, he doesn't want faculty members to have a giant pot of money to spend on whatever they want, whenever they want. The professor's wishes and the institution's wishes and the department's wishes and the donor's wishes have to align. And so how those distributions for endowed chairs are managed has to be clearly stated up front in a policy. Otherwise, the donor, who might have taken classes from that professor, loves that professor, thinks they changed their life, and probably did change their life, they'll talk about what the money ought to be spent on without really any thought about the complexities of institutional finance, the goals of that particular department, and what the institution needs from that philanthropic investment. So it's really important that you have some policy guidance and some alignment between donor, person being honored, and institutional mission and plan. So, great question. Endowment policy. And I'm going to flip this around. So investment policy, it's really a finance committee realm, but you really ought to have written policy guiding with large parameters around how your philanthropic funds are invested. It's probably pooled with your other long-term funds, having a policy about target ranges of portfolio holdings. So the latest board member, who happens to be a billionaire because they invested a lot in Bitcoin, and 12 months ago that they might have been able to convince a board, we really ought to tilt our endowment into Bitcoin. We ought to have a little bit more risk, a little bit more in alternatives, a little bit more in private equity, whatever kind of more high risk, low liquidity, potentially high return, esoteric investment that you might get convinced to pursue. Have a policy thought out with some financial professionals, wealth advisors, one of the big firms out there, they all do it and they do it well, that will help guide you in setting up an investment policy that you follow. Beyond that, an endowment policy. And the difference is an endowment policy will tell you what's your annual distribution. Do you want to pay out 5% based on the market value in a snapshot over the previous 3 years, rolling quarters average? How you want to do that is really important, in that you have a written policy guiding that. Because when people give and invest and create an endowment, they want it to be there in perpetuity, but they also kind of feel like they still own it. And so if the program that they're supporting, they hear that there's this need, they say, well, spend some of my money. It's good to have a policy to fall back on to say, we're not going to invade the corpus, we're not going to take it underwater, we're not going to spend above 5% or whatever the rules are. You're going to follow the endowment policy rules. Okay. Any questions about that? I thought I'd start with the really exciting stuff, the policy things.
Right, one. They do get exciting when you actually have to apply everything.
They do. Yeah. Having those in place helps a lot. All right. So as board members, and this session isn't about fundraising tactics and strategies. This is about the role of the board in fundraising. So one of the key things that you're going to want to do and ask yourself is, how are we doing in philanthropy? You know, the wonderful gift from Bob and Joyce Campbell, Oklahoma Wesleyan probably had an above average year in fundraising because of that gift, right? So, hey, fantastic. That's good for them. We're doing great in philanthropy. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that was their only gift this year. I don't think so. Any of my fellow Bartlesville, Oklahoma Wesleyan folks in here? Okay. So hopefully it was not their only gift, but so really thinking comprehensively and carefully about how are we doing in philanthropy with a long-term view is something the board can help with. So a couple things on this. One is, understand the difference between counting and accounting. Your finance office is going to follow generally accepted accounting principles, and they're going to have an income and expense statement for the institution, and a part of one of those revenue lines will be, you know, external support or philanthropy or whatever they call it. And it's going to be counted following the accounting rules. That does not include, I'm guessing that the Campbells didn't write a $4 million check. They might have, but they might have said, we're going to give you $1 million a year for 4 years. That's a great gift. That needs to be counted, needs to be celebrated for $4 million, needs to be tracked. That may or may not meet the threshold for hitting the financial books. It could be a legally binding agreement that they made that says, you know, and upon my death, my estate is committed, legally obligated to providing the rest of the $4 million if I haven't paid it. You know, I will pay it, and they've signed, and it's a legal commitment against which the institution could sue. Probably would never happen, but against which they could sue. So, that's probably not the gift they made. They probably said, I'll do $1 million a year for 4 years, something like that, and to help pay for this building. Make sure you count that. A bequest intention. Someone who's 65 plus, maybe 60 plus, usually 65 plus, who says, hey, look, Mr. President, I have put Indiana Wesleyan University in my estate plans, and I estimate the value to be $1 million, and you should see that when I pass. And they have their age, they've signed a document that says, I've made that commitment. That's a wonderful gift. That's a wonderful commitment that they've made. Not going to be on your finances, but it should be in what you're counting and what you're celebrating. So understand the difference between counting and accounting, and you ought to have reports on both. And try to get past the arguments about, you know, folks will say, cash is the only thing that I care about. Cash is king. We need cash. No, you want commitments. You want love. You want demonstrations of the love of others. So commitments. They ought to be written, but they don't have to be legally binding. Fair enough? Run rate versus total giving. So this is another key one. And trustees and the higher level administration ought to be able to see over at least 5 years what I call a run rate. Total giving minus bequest realizations. The obvious reason, you can't really predict when someone's going to pass away and you're going to realize a bequest. And a peak gifts. The definition of a peak gift is different for every institution. I've been at some institutions where $1 million is a peak gift, meaning we get maybe two or three of those a year. And sometimes, you know, we get one. Sometimes we may not get any. But you need to consider those peak gifts and thinking about the health and long-term run rate of your philanthropic support. So take out peak gifts, whatever that's defined in your organization, and bequest intentions, and then what's left is a good run rate. And you ought to see growth in that. You, of course, want those bequest intentions, and you want those peak gifts, and there's a lot of work that goes into that, and a lot of support, but because they have their own timeline, and they're hard to predict, and they're tied with individual donors' life circumstances, like the Campbells, they probably couldn't have made that $4 million gift 10 years ago. They're still worried about paying for college for kids or grandkids and retirement and all the things that people think about. But good work was being done with the Campbells. Good relationship maintenance was being done with the Campbells. And so eventually that peak gift came through, and that's important. And, of course, bequests, you know, are obviously very long-term as well. So understand the difference between run rate and those peak gifts. Okay, cost to raise a dollar. As you're investing in philanthropy, you should be asking the question, are we being frugal? Are we being efficient with our investments in philanthropy? Are we investing enough in philanthropy? One benchmark is your cost to raise a dollar. Industry standards for higher ed are about 20 cents to raise a dollar. Now, don't go back to your institution, and if it's over 20 cents or under 20 cents, and say, we need to cut or we need to invest. It's a benchmark. Every institution is different, and the phases of an institution are different. And there's a lot of things that can affect that. So, for instance, are you in boom times or recession? Are you preparing for a campaign in the public phase of a campaign, in the leadership phase of a campaign, or has it been a while since you've had a campaign? Have you had a presidential turnover? Was that presidential turnover smooth and wonderful, or was it rocky and controversial? Are there other controversies at the institution that alumni and supporters might be worried about? Occidental College out by me in Los Angeles, their alumni went berserk, thankfully, when they took their cross off their chapel. Big, you know, made higher ed news and was a big deal. United Methodist School, they took the cross down. It was sort of a symbolic reflection of the reality of where that institution was, which they left their mission, they've gone adrift, but the alumni, they were, especially the ones who were older, who had money and ready to make gifts, really upset, and giving went through the floor. Kind of glad it did. You should be too. Those kinds of controversy, it would be different for our kinds of institutions. Sports programs blow up and have problems, or a professor does something ridiculous and causes a bunch of frustration and angst. Whatever it might be, those are all things that affect cost to raise it all kinds of external factors. But you still ought to track it. It's worth tracking over time. And I would err on the side of over-investing because of the long-term goal here. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the second session, but still worth watching efficiency. Dollars and donors is another thing to really think about. While you want to look at your run rate and total giving, you ought to look at the health of giving throughout giving levels. In wide bands, maybe it's 1 to 1,000, 1,000 to 25,000, and 25,000 and up. Total money from that band of the giving pyramid, if you will, and the total number of donors from that band in the giving pyramid as well. So that you have a good sense, are we growing the base of donors? Are we just living off of a couple of big, huge gifts? Or are we just living off masses of digital media-driven $25 gifts? Always important to be looking at those bands. Another thing when thinking about how are we doing is peers. Your institutions are kind of peers, sort of, but not really. There are institutional aspects that correlate to higher levels of giving. Selectivity and graduation rates, institutions that have low admissions rates, high graduation rates, tend to get a lot more per alum in giving and tend to raise a lot more than like institutions. You think about the Williams and the Bowdens of the world and the Trinities of the world. They raise a ton of money because they get the best and the brightest kids in there. They all graduate. And they have a network of people to help them be successful, and there's a lot of money flowing through that institution. So they tend to graduate. Low selectivity institution tends to serve lower income, tends to, you know, not have as much wealth swirling around it. So find out who your peers are and do some comparisons. But remember, any one year it goes up and down, so don't beat your vice president for advancement up just because one year that school did better than your school. Look at it over time, and it's just another touch point in the question of how are you doing. If you're not participating in the Voluntary Support of Education annual survey, the Council for Advancement and Support of Education, there's a link to it at the end. And that's a link to the VSE, Voluntary Supportive Education. You should be participating in that. That's how you know that you can compare and contrast with how you're doing and the number of donors that you're having at your institution. It takes a little while to fill that out for somebody who's in your data office or your finance office, but I'd encourage you to be involved with that. Also, on the how are you doing, avoid the tactical and the anecdotal. It's good to celebrate events. It's good to celebrate a warm and encouraging meeting with a potential large supporter. But sort through that vis-a-vis all these other kind of touch points. In my career around higher ed advancement, you know, so many times, oh, that was what a great event. What a wonderful event. Okay, well, what kind of follow-up was there with the people in the room that could make a $1 million gift? Was it a fundraising event? What was the ROI? How much did it cost? How much net did you make on it? What other sort of reputational enhancements and benefits were there from that event? It's one thing to go to an event and there's great music, there's a great speaker, and everybody feels good. But your job as advancement professionals and oversight from the board is not to get swayed by the anecdotes that might come out of events, or, oh, I had a great meeting with Bill Gates. Well, okay, so I passed him on the street in Seattle, but, you know, he said hi, he looked at me, and I think I got an in there. So those kind of stories and anecdotes, you just be wary of those and be skeptical of them. I talk a little bit about macro factors, so I won't delve into that anymore. Institutional support. You know, it's one thing to be investing a lot in fundraising, but if the finance office won't return the director of development's phone calls, or the dean refuses to work with the development office, or the marketing office doesn't pay any attention to the marketing needs of fundraising and development, you're not going to do as well. So institutional support is a lot more than just budget investment. It is an understanding throughout the ranks of the institution. And the vice president really needs to drive this, but of course presidential endorsement and support from the bully pulpit is really important as well. Has got to be seen as important. It can't be, and we got to fundraise as well. It's got to be, no, we're in the business of philanthropy. That's an important part of who we are. It's an important part of our future. And everybody needs to support the enterprise. And hopefully the enterprise is well managed, well coordinated, and well run that inspires confidence and inspires that kind of partnership. Any questions about that so far before going to the next slide?
Rob,
yeah.
I'm curious if there's data on campaign impact over general giving beyond the campaign season. Is it like campaigns go up and then general go down? And then is there a way to track donor fatigue in that kind of mix?
Great question. I don't have this slide, but I've got a slide from a colleague of mine that shows the University of Michigan over time, and they've done 7 campaigns over the last 100 years, and it's a very predictable one. Goes up during the campaign, little dip after the campaign, next campaign, and a higher dip and a higher bump each time. But you do see a cycle of out of campaign, giving will go down a little bit, planning for a campaign is still down a little bit, and usually there's strategic planning happening for the institution in that period. And then you'll see the quiet phase where people are making leadership gifts. That's what Bob the Campbells did. You'll see it go up. So you see that a lot. With donor fatigue, that's a real thing, but it's impossible. You can't stop campaigning because it's such an individualized matter. Keep going back to the Campbells. The Campbells probably aren't going to make another $4 million gift in the next campaign, certainly not next year, probably not 5 years, probably not ever again. That was their gift. So they're fatigued. They're probably done for a while. But that's them. Everybody, and that's why you do campaigns, because everybody's at a different life circumstance, and you want to make sure that people, when they're at that moment where they could make that gift, and they're at a moment where they can reflect and think about their life and what they appreciate and what they really care about and what they want to make sure continues for the next generation, that you've got a campaign coming up or around that period. So, you know, at least a campaign every 10 years, because people's life cycles move through that. I don't know.
The things what I've seen with board, this is my fifth institution now, and I see boards really reticent to make it a policy that in order to be a board member, you have to be a donor. Actually, make it a policy. Now, I'm not talking about an amount. I'm not saying, you have to give $5,000 to get a seat at the table. I'm just saying it's a policy that's in their policy manual.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're elected by the denomination. It doesn't mean if you're sent here by Joanne Lyon or Wayne Schmidt, you're their appointed predecessor. If you're at the board and you're a board member, you have to be a donor. And then I'm always telling you what my position is.
I could have guessed.
My question is,
Yeah, I just jumped ahead a couple slides. So I'll just, since this topic's on the table, I'll go ahead and jump right into this slide because it's exactly on that question, which is a perfect question. And the answer is yes. Every board member should make a gift every year. Should make a gift every year. That gift is going to depend on that board member's wherewithal. You got a lot of pastors on your board. They're not going to make, $100,000 gift a year. But a gift. And that's important for a couple reasons. Then the annual personal gift. Personal gift. Not I raised it, I got my buddy to give it, I talked to a company that I work for and they made a gift. A personal gift every year. Other funders look at that, and philanthropic foundations often will say, what percent of your board has made a gift last year? And you don't want to give an answer of anything other than 100%. So every board member needs to make a gift every year. In addition to that...
I think this is where you kind of have to tie a couple things together. It should not come as news to new board members that that's the expectation when they're going to be voting.
Yeah.
I'm starting to go trustee. We sort of have a process of how we onboard trustees and what it takes from the time of earliest consideration. But before they become a trustee, they will be talked about board expectations on the various areas, including giving.
I'm not talking about Indiana Wesleyan, but I'm talking about previous institutions where the expectation was communicated, but it wasn't a policy. They stopped short of making it a policy.
So I would encourage your development committee to put that forward. And I will attach it to this or send it to Kim so it's on there. A couple sample statements, written statements, that are communicated during the board recruitment process or the board orientation process. It shouldn't be a surprise that when they're sitting in their orientation meeting, they've accepted to be a board, that they have to make a gift every year. But a document that says philanthropic expectations for board members. You should have other expectations, show up, be prepared, et cetera, et cetera. But there should be specifics around giving. And those specifics should include what I'm going to go over here in a little bit. And with lots of grace about the level of gift. That's enough said. In addition to the annual personal gift, there should be a give or get threshold. Maybe it's $5,000. So I, board member Rob, I'm going to give $1,000 a year. That's what I can afford. That's, I feel like that's a commitment I can make. And board members, the university ought to be at least in the top three charities that they support. I say top three, and if we weren't church institutions, I'd say top two, because obviously the church should be one, and you can have one other, but your university that you're serving ought to be in that top three. On the give or get, say it's a $5,000 threshold for give or get. From your church, being involved in a fundraising event, maybe you help with a gift that gets counted over time, and it's a $100,000 gift from a colleague or a fellow alum or a friend that you help recruit them to support the university, and they make a gift. But there should be that threshold of getting and fundraising. So every board member should see themselves as part of the philanthropic enterprise and part of bringing philanthropy to the institution. A planned gift commitment. Now, some of your board members are in their 40s, maybe 50s, and it's a little bit early for a bequest. 50s probably not too much. But for every board member to say, I have remembered Indiana Wesleyan in my estate, And I estimate the amount that will be available for Indio Annual Wesleyan upon me and my wife's passing, whatever the, and my children's passing, maybe too, to be $100,000. To have a written commitment on a bequest intention says, I'm in this for the long haul. My life is committed to this. I believe in the mission of this institution, and I want it to do well over time, and so I'm putting it in my estate plans. So, it could be a bequest intention. Maybe it's a different kind of planned gift, a charitable gift annuity, which actually is, has benefits for the donors, or a charitable remainder trust, or some more esoteric planned gift. But those are three elements of levels of commitment. I think every board member ought to make for the institution, again, with grace around the level.
Rob, what's the best practice for board chairs tag teaming with the president to communicate and deliver on these?
Yeah, it ought to be your development. Does everybody have a development committee on their board? Or advancement committee, fundraising committee? Yeah. So it ought to be the chair of the advancement committee. And the board chair. Board chair ought to say something from the podium. And really the advancement committee, along with the advancement committee members, can be charged with following up with board members. You probably have a nominating or membership committee as well. You ought to look. Percent of the board members who gave a gift, and the membership committee ought to know, because I assume that's a small and a hyper-confidential meeting, who did and who didn't make a gift that year. You don't want to embarrass anybody. And ought to also know which ones have met their giver, get their fundraising threshold, and which ones have made a planned gift. And the planned gift, it's over their tenure as a board, so it might not be in their first, second, third, fourth, or fifth year, but in their sixth year they get around to, because it's complicated, right? You got to think about your kids and your life and all that stuff. So, but eventually you make your commitment there. So yes, absolutely. The board chair has a role to endorse it enthusiastically, not with kind of a side comment like, oh yeah, don't forget about your giving. You know, it's got, this is important. This is who we are. And as a member of this group, you've committed to doing this. And I've asked Lisa, the chair of our advancement committee, and the advancement committee members to follow up with each of you to talk about your commitment. Absolutely. Now, your vice president for advancement can be the one to follow up on the planned giving, because they, or maybe a director of planned giving, should have some expertise in that area. And those are more complex, more protracted conversations with individuals, and so they might be doing some follow-up. But to have that conversation, start with the board chair and your advancement committee chair and members to follow up. That's the way to go about it. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. You don't want to put your president in the position of running around, you know, shaking down. I should use that term, but his bosses. So. Yep. Yeah, and the trusteeship committee, membership committee, nominate, whatever you call it, is they're the ones who had to have the really difficult conversations, right? So the philanthropy committee is going out promoting giving, saying, you know, these are some ways you can give. This is, you know, if this is important, is anything I can do to help you? Would you like to meet with our planned giving expert to talk about estate planning, et cetera, and have that conversation to make sure that board members have had every opportunity to live up to the expectations that there are for giving. The report on where people are goes to the trusteeship committee, and when you do your annual review of board members, that's the committee that then ought to say, well, Jill is not really doing it. She hasn't given for 2 years, and she doesn't look like she's going to do it. And then that's the conversation with the board member, and how I've been chair, board chair, and probably president. In case there's some kind of odd circumstances happening, you want to have grace, right? It could be an illness, could be a family tragedy, could be, who knows? They've invested everything they can in their new business, and if it doesn't go, everything's down the tubes, or they could hit it big, whatever it is. But there's a life circumstances there that the president and the vice president for advancement might be privy to that the board isn't. But then if there's that conversation where, hey Jill, tell me a little bit more about this. We really want you to be able to be a full-fledged member of the board and thriving as a board member, and this is important to us. How can we help you? And maybe she needs to move on. Yeah. You ought to be ambassadors and advocates, right? And not your boards, but some boards can tend to be environments where they talk about this issue and this problem and that problem, which it's okay, it's part of governance sometimes. But don't take that outside of the boardroom. And don't make that every time you come out of a board meeting where you think, ooh, we've got some real issues to deal with. Stop and remember the mission. Remember the lives that are being changed. Remember the impact of the institution on the culture and on the students. And understand what the good things are that are happening at your institution. Read the alumni magazine. Listen to the report from the president. Absorb the communications from the institution. And grab those pieces of interesting good news and be an active advocate for your institution. Hey, did you know that our basketball team just won an NAIA championship, or we had someone, you know, an All-American? Or did you know that our pre-med program has 100% of its students in med school this last year? Whatever those things are, know them. That's what you should be talking about outside of those board meetings. Constant, unrelenting, over-the-top optimism, cheerleading, and advocacy.
I could add just a slight comment to that. It would be, I think of all people who should be challenged to give unrestricted general support gifts, the board is one of those who really should be challenged to give the pure unrestricted support. For one thing, if a trustee says, I want to channel mine just to this program, people sort of start going, well, there must be sort of, you know, on campus, like, well, now there's a trustee advocate for that department. But there's not one for other stuff. And in many ways, I think the board members are the ones who most can set the standards. And we give because we believe in the institution and its mission, and not because I have a personal stake in a particular program.
Another great point. On that personal gift, you might want to think about saying a personal, unrestricted gift every year. Your major gift is probably going to be tied to something you have a deeper passion about, and your planned gift is probably going to, but absolutely, ditto to everything you just said. Okay, I've covered all this. I'm going to go back up. Any other questions about that? There's a lot more about. Well, let me talk. Let me see if. You know what? I'm going to go on and talk about this a little bit more, since we're on board member specific board. This is board members as individuals. Some of the other things, besides being a just over the top ambassador and cheerleader, be an augment to gratitude. So the institution, when someone makes a gift, the institution is going to send them a thank you letter. If it's above a certain amount, they probably are going to get a call from the president or the vice president, and maybe even lunch or dinner, or, you know, a lot of love is going to happen from the institutions that's kind of programmatic, automated to some extent, but there will be gratitude that's given. For you as board members to augment that gratitude when you hear about a large gift, and your advancement department, if it's part of the strategy that they want to pursue, might even facilitate this by saying, here's a list of people that have made gifts in the last 6 months. If you happen to know someone, even if you don't, their phone number's there, give them a call and coordinate that a little bit. But for you as a board member to reach out to someone and say, hey, Bob and Joyce, I heard about this wonderful gift that you made to Oklahoma Wesleyan, and you know I'm serving on the board there. I know you used to. I just wanted to reach out and tell you, I'm just blown away. I couldn't be more grateful. I'm so passionate about that institution, and to know that you've made that kind of investment. Tell me about that. Why'd you do that, and how you feeling about that? And just thank them and love them for their generosity. And to do that for folks that made a $1,000 gift or a $100 gift, especially if somebody's in their 20s and 30s and just starting in the habit of giving, they will remember that their whole lives. So augment gratitude. Take time to do that. And it's fun. You'll get new friends. You'll if you happen to live in the same town, you might have lunch and develop a relationship. So it's a easy and good thing to do. I talked about the perpetual infomercial. Just be informed and be aware and be that cheerleader. Be intentional about inviting people to stuff. Take them to a ball game, a concert, an event, a lecture. Your institution, if you can. I know a lot of you are scattered across the country, but if you're going back for an alumni weekend, talk it up on Facebook. Say, hey, I'm going to be back. I'd love to have you come back. Getting people reconnected with the institution, having them experience the campus, remembering the joy that they had. And if you're in a community, my dear friends up in Houghton, there's not a lot there other than Houghton College. But if you happen to be in a place that has a community around it, and there's, invite your, business colleagues and those you interact with in different ways. Bring them to campus. Even simply, hey, have you seen? We've got this great new building. You got to come check it out. And you don't need to get anyone's permission to walk on campus and walk around a building and say, hey, during business hours. You take them to lunch. Take them to the cafeteria. Let them experience, see the students and the food may or may not be as good as they'd get at a nice restaurant in town. But take them there and walk them around campus and show them the neat things that are happening, the new building, whatever else. Means a lot, and it does a lot. You don't have to ask. You don't have to pressure them. Just it's cool stuff. You want to show them. Now, referrals. So, I'm going to give you two real stories that I experienced as an advancement VP. Sitting in a meeting, a board development committee meeting. And we were presenting them with lists of people that we had researched and thought about because we knew that they were wealthy, they had the capacity to make large gifts, and they were connected to the institution in some way. They were an alum, they lived in the town, they'd given in the past, their child, whatever it was. They had a connection, they had capacity and connection. And a board member says, I don't see Rush Limbaugh on this list. Honest. No, he's not on there. Well, his radio show is really doing well. He's making a lot of money. And, I've heard of him. I know about him. And says, well, we should reach out to him. Not helpful. Now, that's a ridiculous example, but a true one. But you could take it down, at some, do you know the CEO of the biggest company in town? They saw in the newspaper that this person is doing really well. Have you? Chances are your advancement staff know who the wealthiest people in the larger universe around the institution. If they're not connected at all, the question that you should be asked is, do you know them well enough to introduce them, to bring them to campus, or introduce me to them, or introduce them to the president if they're at a high enough level? So as board members, really think about your referrals. It ought to be someone you have a personal connection with that you know from firsthand knowledge is wealthy and potentially inclined to give, and you would be comfortable in an introductory email, or maybe not even that, say, look, this person's my boss, they own the company, I don't want to be the one, but you should reach out to them, and you know, I'll try and find a way of bringing your institution to their attention. Your referrals ought to have real meat to them, real personal connection, and not just Rush Limbaugh. And then, of course, some board members are in a position and are comfortable to actually partner in the cultivation of a gift and even participate in the solicitation. Not all board members are comfortable in that. Sometimes the relationship with that individual, it's their boss, the owner of their company, or their brother, and they've got their own issues with their brother. Not me, of course. My brother's just wonderful. But they don't want to talk to them about a gift. So, you know, you have to be sensitive to that, and you can't push that. But occasionally there is that. And it should be a partnership with your advancement office if you're going to go down that path, because you don't know what conversations are already in place, what other people, other board members, other volunteers might be doing. So those are just a few things about how board members and individuals can help. When does this session end? I don't remember.
10:30.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me just go back and I'll just run through a couple things real quick here. All right. Just a real quick. Along with counting, setting goals, campaign goals. Be thoughtful about it. It shouldn't be, I've drawn a line through some of this, it shouldn't be a mathematical subtraction. Well, we need this to build the building, and we can finance about half of that, so our fundraising goal is $20 million. Or your operating budget next year, well, we don't want to make any hard decisions, and so our fundraising goal for next year is the gap between our projected revenue and what we really need and our projected expenses, so we got to raise that. And it shouldn't be a whim, it shouldn't be bravado of, excuse me, Mr. President, of the president, say, because that institution over there is doing $100 million, surely we can do a $100 million campaign, we got to do that. Or 200 or whatever that number is. We gotta be bold. Let's go for 500. We're ready for a $1 billion campaign. Whatever that is, it ought to be based on your known available prospects, your run rate, your pipeline of development of prospects. Take the time and spend the money to do a feasibility study. Where you bring in an external consultant to come in and think about, are your prospects as ready as you think they are? People are amazingly transparent with consultants, and will share all kinds of really great information with them about how ready your top suspects are, to make a large gift. And you ought to have goals on the number of dollars as well as the number of donors that give. And think about even doing that at a couple levels. The typical gift pyramid have a couple different levels. And the campaign ought to focus on the commitment side, not the gap accounting side. So philanthropic commitments. And also have a goal for planned gifts. Number of planned gifts, dollar value of planned gifts. A typical campaign is going to be about 30-35% in deferred gifts, bequest intentions, charitable trusts, charitable gift annuities, etc. So have a goal for that and watch that. People are going to give how they're going to give, but you don't want everybody to make a bequest intention that's kind of soft. They might change it later, although stats will say that 93-95% of people who write that they're going to leave you in their will, do leave you in their will for that amount. Used to be 97%. I guess the integrity of donors is slipping a little bit over the years. So it's now around 93-95%. It's the latest study. But it's a pretty solid commitment. But you don't want your whole campaign to be bequest commitments. Board's roles, you ought to react to what the campaign priorities are. Your administration will lead a strategic planning process and have some things that they believe need to be supported. Board, as well as a feasibility study, actually more importantly, frankly, than the board, because of the nature of our boards, many of your best donors are not on the board. Make sure you think about, you know, what's being highlighted, and invest in a consultant. Unless you've got several well-experienced people in your advancement shop that have run several campaigns, it's really helpful to have an external consultant who will come in on a regular basis to help guide that effort and to help make sure that you're approaching your campaign in a way that it's going to be successful, not only dollar goal, but in a way that people have joy about it and don't make the institution at the end think, whew, I'm glad that's over, let's never do that again. Let's, you know, an outside consultant can keep you on track and keep you moving forward and give you a lot of good experience from other campaigns. I think that's what I wanted to share in this session. Just a list of some we've talked about a lot of these. It'll be in the deck for you to look at. Some helpful questions to ask as board members. Not are we doing a car wash, but is the advancement operation adequately staffed and resourced? Is the base of donors growing over time? What is the run rate trend? Keep the questions at a higher level, not tactical. I got this direct mail piece and I didn't like the picture. Well, maybe you can pass that along outside of a committee meeting, but keep your board conversations at a much higher, more strategic level. So I think I'll leave it there with questions. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Major gifts, people who work with individuals. I'll talk more about this in the next, in my afternoon sessions, which is actually on the nuts and bolts of fundraising and not board oversight. There's ways to assess progress and success and that give trust to development officers in those conversations, which to some extent are, you know, highly confidential, highly personal, and there's, you know, when you're in the room with that donor, you have to trust what folks are hearing, and so that there's a lot to that. But you should be asking, you know, how do we measure a success of our fundraising tactics? Major gifts is one tactic, and I'll talk about other tactics this afternoon. But that's a good trustee question. Are we measuring our tactical or success of various tactics, and how do we do that? Not is that tactic right? Is that measurement, you know, going in the right direction? That's the president's job and the vice president's job. But so, any other questions, comments? Thank you all, and thanks for being involved at our universities. Appreciate it.